Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by Drs. Scott Keith and Adam Francisco. We finally are going to get around to some of the apologetic questions that I've been teasing for so long. We did two introductory episodes, then we did an episode on the book Faithless to Fearless and with David Anderson, and now we can start getting into some of these questions and some of these posts I've seen about apologetic questions. And we're going to dive straight into some of the resurrection stuff, because I think that's what we've highlighted is really important. That's under quote-unquote investigation here, is sort of the circumstances around Jesus' death and resurrection, and then what does that mean? And so that's what we'll do today. But before that, I want to give a thank you to people who have gone and given the show ratings and reviews on iTunes. I already got a couple of responses from the people claiming their free book from the
last episode.
That was fast. You know, inside lingo here, we're actually only recording 2 days later from that last episode. So within 2 days, you know, most of those books have been claimed, which is cool. I think there's one dangling around there. By the time you listen to this episode, it's probably gone, so I'm sorry about that. But, you know, and we've also, I had somebody message me on Twitter, or I think actually just publicly tweeted it, that they went to go review the show because my intros have been making them feel guilty. And then when to do it, they realized that they reviewed it about a year ago, so they just updated their review.
Nice.
So I think that's great, too. You know, I kind of want to apologize for the guilt, but not really. You know, if you feel bad about not reviewing the show,
you should.
You should go review the show. I mean, I'll give you a little penance to solve your guilt. No, that's bad. We should absolve you instead. So, in true Thinking Fellows style, if Jim Nesigan were here, he would mass absolve every guilty reviewer. But again, thank you. If you've still been considering doing that, I'm just going to say the same thing I've been saying for the last couple of weeks, which is, you know, the beginning of the show right here is a great time to pause the episode, pull up your browser, unless you're driving, and give us a review on Apple Podcasts. I've been putting that link in the show notes so that even if you do not listen on Apple Podcasts, you can go review the show there and you know, help us out. Yeah, I do want to emphasize it's not just about sort of looking good on Apple. This actually affects the way you appear in search results and directory results on Apple Podcasts, but also on third-party podcasting apps. Most third-party podcasting apps use Apple Podcasts directory of shows, and the way that directory appears affects basically everything. There's a few out there that don't use Apple's directory, Stitcher, for example, Spotify, but you know, most of the big ones that have been around for 5-10 years use Apple's directory. So this is helping, you know, all around, not just for iPhone users. So again, we appreciate that. All right, guys, let's dive into this episode. So I saw an interesting one. We've been talking about the importance of the resurrection. I think even in the introductory episode, we went back and talked about how, you know, like even the claims of Jesus and his claim to be God sort of hinges on this event. In past episodes, we've done the C.S. Lewis, liar, lunatic, and
Lord.
Lord, that's right. And so I saw something interesting, and I thought you guys might get a kick out of this. So there was a thread from an atheist on Twitter, okay, and it starts like this. The resurrection of Jesus, if true, does not prove that the Christian God exists. It means that resurrections are possible, that a resurrection doesn't actually mean anything about Christ's divinity. We could intuit that a resurrection means those claims, but it could also mean there was a necromancer in proximity. And it was kind of throwing it out there for Christians to deal with this problem. Yeah. Somebody did point out, hey, he predicted this.
Yeah.
And then they just sort of dismissed it. Well, maybe he was special and had some premonitions. But
yeah, maybe that specialness was that he was God.
Yeah, but premonitions and being God are two different things. This was actually one of the most interesting objections I've seen. Usually they're not actually this sophisticated.
Yeah. I mean, I don't mean that really, but good on him for at least I don't know how to put it, but acknowledging that what matters is what really happened, and not just assuming, like a lot of atheists might, assuming a naturalistic worldview and saying, oh, all there is nature, and nature is all there is, and therefore nothing supernatural or miracles don't occur. This is a little much more sophisticated, right? I think if Rod were here, he would say something like, well, maybe we go to the person who actually rose from the dead for an explanation for the meaning of that resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what does Jesus say about his forthcoming resurrection? That it is the validation of his claims.
And it is
that he was before Abraham was, that he and the Father are one, and so on. So if you're going to, I mean, this business about a necromancer and these other things, that's all, I mean,
well, I okay. think even that is theoretical. You know, this is on Twitter. I don't know this individual, but I would imagine since this that this person, so this wasn't an argument from naturalism, which was part of its uniqueness, but I would bet this person doesn't actually believe in the existence of necromancers. Right. Maybe they do.
It's a red herring.
But I would say even the majority of people who are clinging to this, liking it, retweeting and things like that, probably don't believe that there are necromancers walking around today or that they were walking around in the first century. So I think there's part of that, right? Like you said, this is sort of, he's making up probably, which was interesting is that they're spiritual or they're non-natural possibilities for the resurrection, right? Mm-hmm. And usually what we get are naturalistic mm-hmm. explanations, like the disciples stole the body or they hallucinated or whatever. And this was another one where it was sort of miraculous, where he's saying there could be other miraculous explanations.
I mean, it's common.
Could be.
Yeah,
sorry to interrupt
there
you.
Could, but his could his comment is smart in that way.
Yeah, yeah, and but the thing is, if you're going to look at a claim about what happened in history, if you're actually doing history, you order your claim around the evidence that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is there evidence for a necromancer? Do you know of any?
No,
I don't.
Scott? In fact, no. And no enemies of Christ ever said something like there were necromancers or.
Yeah, the evidence is, and we've done so many shows on this, but the evidence is, it's really hard to get around, if you're following the evidence, the explaining the empty tomb by the fact that Jesus rose from the dead. Mm-hmm. That's what all the evidence points to. Now,
it's not even be conceding that, okay, I give up. There was an empty tomb.
Yeah, right? there are other, we could probably come up with maybe 73 explanations for the empty tomb, maybe give or take a few. But if we're going to answer why was the tomb empty in a historical way, our answer has to correspond to the evidence. You can make, maybe an alien flew out over the tomb on Good Friday or
so,
Saturday morning and sucked up
the
bodies.
Even the person that's saying this on Twitter only knows of the existence of Jesus from the same text that we would use to try to find what the evidence says regarding his death and resurrection. So if you're saying, you know, those that say Jesus' resurrection from the dead prove that he's God, well, you're already sort of giving in to the fact that the texts that we're going to use to talk about Jesus are...
Said something accurate.
Well, that they're a given, right? Mm-hmm. That there are texts that say something about Jesus. Obviously, this person thinks that some of what they say are untrue. And not the only explanation, but Adam's point that this is the evidence that we have, right? These texts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that's the evidence we have. The eyewitness testimonies we have are there. And so if you want to sort of figure out what happened at a particular event, you have to look at the evidence before you. Otherwise, you're just speculating.
Yeah. Let me make a little advertisement.
Mm-hmm.
David Anderson, we interviewed, was it last episode ago? Is that where this will fall? His book, Faithless to Fearless, and his argument is it's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but it's in addition to that, it's certain conceded facts that with the exception of some outliers, there are facts that all historians concede to. The death of Jesus, the burial of Jesus.
I think it's important
and the empty tomb.
Take another second on, with the exception of a few outliers that are generally... I mean, they're outliers in the truest sense of that word. Their idea that, say, Jesus never even existed is not a commonly held belief among even pagan historians.
They're the dudes who are on ancient aliens.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean by outliers. Now, there are, you know, globally speaking, there are, you know, with regard to Islam, for example, they don't think that Jesus really died on a cross, that he was taken up into heaven. So there's some also some big exceptions. But thinking about our world, the Western world, the outliers are all fringe believers in aliens and things like that. Every historian worth their salt certainly acknowledges, even John Dominic Crossan of the Jesus Seminar fame.
Yeah.
You know, one of the most liberal skeptical groups to study the Bible back in the late 80s and in the 90s. His biography of Jesus is, I think it's titled Jesus, A Revolutionary Biography is the subtitle. And he says in there, if there's one thing we can say for certain, and this is a guy who, with his so-called scholarly buddies, his fellows, they literally democratically voted on the things, on whether Jesus said something or not. So in his biography, so he's a super skeptic, super not at all committed to anything Orthodox or even Christian, but he says in his biography that if there's one thing we can know for certain is that Jesus did in fact die on a Roman cross somewhere around 30 to 33 AD.
Interesting.
Now he's going to go on and foolishly claim that too. He doesn't know where the body went. He says that maybe it was just thrown in a pile of trash and eaten by wild dogs. But the evidence that we have
more obvious that that might have happened than what was actually written down.
Right. Well, that's his way of getting out of explaining the empty tomb.
Yeah.
I can't give you a percentage point, but professional historians who approach, like we did in the episode maybe a couple months ago on how do you approach history, who let the evidence do the speaking, not uncritically. You know, they'll look at the way, especially literary evidence, will concede that he died, that he was buried in a tomb, and that on Sunday morning, that tomb was empty. And there's lots of reasons to believe it was empty, including the attempt by the high priests. When they paid off the guards of the tomb to explain to everybody, yeah, the tomb is empty, but it's because the disciples stole the body. So you have an empty tomb. How are you going
to
explain it?
And people trying to explain it from day one, essentially, right? Like people have been trying to explain the empty tomb theories since the
That's exactly how they should have gone after Christianity. Christianity's critics should go after the resurrection of Jesus. Per Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, it's all a scam. That's a Francisco or 1517's paraphrase of the Bible.
You know,
we have all believed a lie. We're dead, still dead in our trespasses and sins. We've believed a lie and so on. It shouldn't surprise us that Christianity's critics would go after the resurrection. The interesting thing is when you look at it, the concurrent theories explaining the empty tomb or explaining the early and very early Christian testimony that Jesus rose from the dead is, I think in the volume you edited for the last Here We Still Stand conference, another advertisement.
Credo.
I deal with this in a couple of paragraphs, the claim that those who claim Jesus rose from the dead were hallucinating. Mm-hmm. And there are hundreds of these. Is indeed possible.
Yeah, you do that.
But it's as much of a miracle, perhaps, as Jesus rises from the dead, because 500 people hallucinating, having the same hallucinogenic experience.
I think in Resurrection chapter, or is this somebody else? There's a chapter in there that deals with like a modern psychologist's take on 500 people hallucinating.
Yeah, there's no record of it whatsoever. Every hallucinogenic experience is unique to that particular individual.
Well, over periods of time too, like in different people in different places having the same hallucination,
days of separation
of seeing the risen Christ.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, it would have been really easy for Christianity to be put to rest
in its early stages.
Oh yeah, I mean, when Paul says to Agrippa in Acts 26, this was not done in a corner. And Paul, and he says to the court there, as you all know, this was not done in a corner. King Agrippa himself knows that the death and resurrection of Jesus was a public event. It would have been really easy to get to the bottom of what really happened if they could have produced a body, they would have been able to get it. They had every means, motive, and opportunity to do so right from the get-go.
I think this question also, that was presented here in this tweet, also gets to the heart of the difference between the facts and the interpretation of those facts, right? Which are the interpretation offered by Christians in this case, which is that Jesus is God because of these events, is being discounted because Christians or the texts in which those facts occurred want him to be God. Because of some sort of bias, it's being disregarded. Mm-hmm. And I see this as common too, which, you know, people go, if you have something to prove, then whatever explanation is most reasonable amongst those people who don't have something to prove, that must be the one that's really correct. And that's, you know, that's becoming more and more common to hear. But what's interesting is that if you're kind of conceding that the facts presented in the Gospels are correct, that in fact the tomb was empty, that he was crucified in this manner, that he was tried in this manner, if you're conceding those facts already, you're conceding that something accurate was transcribed and handed down, that this text already has some inherent accuracy, but now you're sort of questioning the accuracy of its interpretation of those events. So I think actually it's on you to sort of prove why it would be accurate for pure historical means and inaccurate in its interpretation of those historical events.
Yeah, I think, in addition to that, most would say the reason why they would take that line, that they'll acknowledge some of the historical accuracy, because it's much easier to believe natural sort of events, you know, where there's human causation or natural causation. This gets to the worldview issue again, is really what's at behind the rejection of the resurrection is not a weakness or a limitation of the evidence. It's a worldview that the person looking at whatever it is they're looking at, in this case, the resurrection, the limitations of their worldview. Their worldview will not allow for a resurrection.
Right.
That necromancer comment from the tweet, that's a red herring.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's just a distraction. It really is a worldview issue. And they're in a very comfortable position because the naturalist worldview has been around and it, by and large, has predominated Western thinking.
The dominant position.
Yeah, for centuries now.
Yeah.
Even in a postmodern age where we allegedly have moved past worldview and ideology, that's baloney. Baloney. I know Christians who would describe themselves as naturalists in that they would say that when it comes to explaining things in time and space, we should always seek a natural explanation, at the very least, initially.
You see this on the History Channel. They'll do, you know, there's been ones where they explain how miracles in the Old Testament could have happened by natural means.
Sure.
Like I saw one, I mean, there's like an hour.
Like crossing the Red Sea.
Yeah, that one's interesting, right? They do these phenomena about how certain winds come in and shift the waters. And look, there is a land
bridge. Well, it has to be the Red Sea. Well, anyway, but oftentimes they do play games with the geography to say that they actually crossed a different sea, different place.
Mm-hmm. Much shallower place.
Much shallower place. As if the people then didn't know where they were.
Yeah. Oh, they'll say that. They'll be like, well, they didn't know the difference between these two bodies of water. They thought they were connected like that.
That's called, C.S. Lewis called that kind of thing chronological snobbery.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Well,
The gross assumption that we today are brighter, more sophisticated, more intelligent than those of the past.
Well, there's,
You know, remember when we were talking the other night, of course our listeners wouldn't be privy to this, but we were talking about the Tolkien movie.
Yeah.
You know, you think early 20th century when everybody's just drunk on or high on just how sophisticated and advanced we are. And then a couple of years later, you've got guys with flamethrowers.
Yep.
Burning people alive.
Burning people alive in trenches.
You have that 1917 movie we went to go see.
Yeah.
Oof. Yeah.
Yeah. I think this is not one-upping you, but maybe adding to you. G.K. Chesterton described chronological snobbery in a way. He says something like, it's just the oligarchy of whoever happens to be walking around at the
corner. That's right. Of who's in control of the quote-unquote narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think to me this highlights the importance that we've been talking about of apologetics not being separated from the proclamation of the gospel or what it truly means that Christ rose for the dead. not just generically in history, but for you, mm-hmm. and how that applies to you, or even how we might say in this more, in this way, that how the interpretations of those events being communicated properly and accurately is just as, is equally important to sort of the raw historical data about the mm-hmm. fact that, say, sort of having knowledge about the historical Jesus doesn't save. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the realm where, like, apologetics and Christian doctrine and Christian preaching really meet together, where sometimes these things are taken as totally separated. Yeah. But in reality, when you hit the ground running with these kinds of things, the conversations tend not or should not be totally separated, or even those times where I myself have fallen prey to being them totally separated, mm-hmm. You're not really getting anybody closer to faith in Christ. You're sort of just right. in a debate at this yeah. point.
The devil himself knows Jesus rose from the dead.
Right, the devils. They knew his name. They know him. They know the facts.
Yeah.
So, okay, cool. I mean, I think that's a great way of handling this. You know, I saw some people responding in the thread, and the responses you could tell were frantic in some cases, because somebody had just never been hit with a miraculous account of what happened, rather than mm-hmm. these naturalistic ones, right? Even when I saw it, I was like, oh, dang, that's pretty genius there. You're just sort of giving into the miraculous. Although, like you pointed out, once you've given into the miraculous, well, now we're talking about which miraculous explanation mm-hmm. is yeah. most probable.
Yeah, yeah, that's a much easier yeah. conversation.
And in all honesty, it's the one that's, you know, if the document's already accurate, it's the one being testified to.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yep.
So if it were something like a necromancer or some other witchcraft or something like that, you know, none of those were given as plausible accounts in the earlier ages of human history. We don't have any secular...
Yeah, and there is, I believe it's William Lane Craig who makes the distinction between a resuscitation mm-hmm. and a resurrection.
But even that one's naturalistic, right? That claims he doesn't die.
Well, that's the thing. So Lazarus... Jesus raises him, mm-hmm. but eventually he dies.
Yes.
Right.
Whereas Jesus dies, but then rises and then ascends into heaven.
To right. never die again.
So, I mean, I don't know how that fits, but it's probably worth
examining as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. Into there.
Because I don't know. I've never looked into it, but you see these shows on, well, whatever it would be. I just get them through YouTube, but weird stuff that goes on around the world, right? Mm-hmm. CNN had this show on, oh, who was it? Reza Aslan, who's at the University of California in Riverside. He's written a terrible biography of Jesus. I think he's a Shia Muslim, kind of progressive Muslim, but he went around and looked at all these quirky things in religion, you know, visiting sadhus in India where they're eating brains, and but... There are accounts of real miraculous things. They could probably be explained away naturalistically if you took the time, mm-hmm. but things like in India and like the way outside of what we might call civilization. So what might appear to a lot of people like a resurrection could just be a revivification of someone. But the testimony about Jesus is that he rose and he's still living.
Yeah.
Unlike a Lazarus, for example.
Yeah, so...
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I sometimes think, too, that, you know, one of the bigger arguments, too, is that he just wasn't really dead. And I think that one's yeah. handled pretty handily by that, I think it's like 1978, an MD's examination of the evidence for Jesus' death or something.
Yeah, it was in JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association.
Yeah. I mean, where this guy, he just goes through and... He lists out what every single thing, one of these events that Jesus suffered would do to his body. Mm. And then what, you know, the blood and water running out of the pierced side actually signifies, you know, rupturing of the pericardial sac, which after death is congested with water. Mm-hmm. And that's why blood and water ran out. And they knew, and the Romans knew this meant that they were dead.
Yeah. I always find it kind of humorous, the people who put forward what's called the swoon theory, you know. That it presumes that the Romans didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah.
You read just superficially into Roman history, these are...
They were killing machines.
They know how to execute someone.
Execution machines.
Yeah. We have at Concordia, there's in the history suite, I don't know who does this, but they always put a question up on this whiteboard. What have the French given us? You know, and you can imagine where that might go. The latest question is, what have the Romans given us? And, you know, there's things like abs on gladiators and you know, whoever wants who puts whatever they want on there, and including manscaping. And, but then, are we going to lose our...
No, we're good. Okay. We're
good. our rating, but
one is like 3 stars.
One is four certain or executions leading to 4 certain death or something like that. I mean, they were almost scientific in their approach to executions.
Yeah, and you know, I think there's also something to understanding that not everybody you meet with a quote-unquote apologetic concern is actually interested in investigating these things or talking about it. Some people just hate Christianity, right? Like sometimes you're just dealing with somebody who hates Christianity or hates religion, has a very visceral emotional reaction to these things, right?
And well, this is Dr. Montgomery's and says this in Sensible Christianity that it's right off the bat when he's sort of doing his apologetics do's and don'ts. He says, you know, there's a danger in taking the non-believer's argument too seriously, and there's a danger in not taking it seriously enough.
Mm-hmm.
And the apologist's task is to sort of, you know, fish out the authentic questions and do their best.
To discern it. There are bad faith actors out there when it comes to these sorts of things. And, you know, part of it's hard, right? Because this comes from this charge to proclaim the gospel to people. And when those opportunities arise and you take it, you don't just sort of want to quit, right? Part of this is realizing when no good is happening anymore. And in fact, maybe even harm as the debate gets emotionally charged further or something like that. Or even you getting worked up and shook, right? That at some point, just back out, right? You've done what you can. That's there's the theory of apologetics and there's actually doing
practice,
it. And I think we've said a lot in this series. You know, when I'm imagining apologetic conversations, I'm not imagining like debates on a university campus, while those do certainly happen, or even sort of talking to somebody of a different religion or an atheist on an airplane or something. I think for most people, this comes down to statistically probably their kids, right?
I'd
or
say
their grandkids.
Kids or grandkids. When I go, I don't know about Adam, but when I go out to sort of LCMS congregations and teach apologetics, the big concern, you know, the people in the room, I'm not there doing apologetics to the people in the room who are unbelievers, because the people in the room are lifelong believers.
Yep.
And for many of them, their lives have been pretty long. And so their concern is often for their children who haven't been in church for 20 years or their grandchildren who've never been in church. And they feel like they don't know what to say at Thanksgiving when... You know, the questions maybe come up just in the normal course of conversation. And I think that's...
Yeah, hard conversations
that's
can come
probably,
up because you prayed over dinner, right? You see that person, like, you'll pray over dinner at Thanksgiving, let's say, and you see the person in the corner who's bowing their head, folding their hands, but not saying anything, right? And sort of tensions rise. And that this tends to happen.
Yeah, you make the distinction between theory and practice a little earlier. I do think there's a whole lot of... wisdom in really thinking about our basic disposition in the, whether it's the public arena or at the Thanksgiving meal, especially if you're like a lifelong Christian and you were raised in a very Christian sort of environment, you just assume that people are going to respect Christianity, that Christianity, the church has some sort of authority. And sad to say that those days are not over everywhere, but they are largely over in, you know, the cities and
they're waning and for sure.
To be sure. And being none of us likes it.
No.
But being comfortable in that arena. I mean, even a guy like Luther, who lives in the midst of Christendom, can in his Galatians commentary very early on say when it, you know, he's talking about how what he's arguing and what he's describing in his text is for people who have a high view of the Bible. This is paraphrasing Luther. But when he says, and this is almost verbatim, he says, when it comes to Jews, Turks, and those are the Muslims in his day and age, and other sectarians, you're in a totally different arena. There, you have to be as wise and subtle as a controversialist, is the way it's translated, as possible. So even a guy living in Christendom recognizes, even a guy like Luther, who everybody bloviates about how much he despises reason, which is totally baloney, recognizes context really does matter in terms of where you start. It doesn't change the content, but it will tell you, or it ought to tell you, where you're going to start your conversation. Your conversation might be starting with conversation about football, which Scott and I know a whole lot about.
Yeah, tons, man. It's funny. This occurred, what you're saying very much occurred to me over the past, I'd say, 2 years as my daughter starts dating a little bit more. And it's like, at some point you go, are there any Christian young men of dating age out there? Because every person...
Watch out, you're going to get emails.
every person that she meets...
We should... 1517 should have an app.
No.
Yeah,
like
a dating app for autumn.
I just saw the other day there was a...
I'm kidding.
Tulip singles for lonely Calvinists.
But at any rate, it's just... The only thing that ended up occurring to me is just that it's not a Christian world.
Right.
It's just not, you're not going to throw a rock at a group of boys, and just happen to hit a Christian. At least not where we live.
Yeah. And amidst Christians, so I'm thinking over 10 years ago, it was either Newsweek or Time had a one-page piece and with the title, "We're All Hindus Now." You can probably Google that. And it was an article based or looking at some findings in a Pew Research questionnaire.
Which is always a little scary.
Yeah, the Pew Research concluded that 75% of Americans would at least identify. They would name themselves as Christians.
Right.
But then when
75, wow.
Well, yeah, but then it's
cultural.
Don't be too excited.
I'm never too excited about it.
The questioner asks...
I generally try to never be too excited. Well,
I get that. The article then asks questions like about, do you believe in reincarnation?
Yes.
Do all paths lead to the same destination?
Yes.
Yeah, and it said half of that 75%...
Said yes.
So hence the title, "We're All Hindus Now." And it's rhetoric, it's hyperbole, but the point was that... Most Americans, including Christians, hold to assumptions that don't fit with the classic or orthodox Christian view of things, and in fact is much more commensurate with the Eastern
religion.
Hindu worldview.
Yeah, it's interesting that it's... if you go and sort of teach apologetics, even in, Orthodox Lutheran churches, I'd say as much as Adam and I have, you find out very quickly that the average person will accept, it's called syncretism, will accept many more beliefs to be compatible or in concert with Christianity than actual Orthodox Christian doctrine would say are.
Mm-hmm.
Just like what Adam is saying, and a lot of it is just this, stuff that you would guess, like, if I try to be the best person I can, then I'm sure God's going to reward me in heaven. That all paths lead to the, just believe something, because all paths lead to the, as long as you're trying to believe in something, it's all going to lead to the same good place for you.
Yeah.
This is true if you're a LCMS Lutheran. This is true in our churches for sure, too. And I would think that most pastors from teaching an adult Bible class on Sunday know that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those are Christians. They say they're Christians, and I pray every day that they cling to Christ as their only hope for salvation. But when pressed, they've got some really interesting beliefs about things.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to plug a blog that went up today on the day of recording, but a week ago, if you're listening to this, I think, that I did. I think I wrote it. It's called recapturing the need for catechesis. And sort of the point I'm making here, because I'm actually, this happened before all this, but I'm thinking a lot about preventative medicine lately. And catechesis is sort of that for this problem of people who, your children who left. And, you know, I don't want to get in trouble, but, you know, some of the one and done of catechesis properly, as we talk about it in the LCMS and in other Lutheran churches here, and, you know, Christian education doesn't take place in the home and stuff like that. This is what I'm trying to say we need to recapture, is that some of these hard to have conversations with your kids once they're adults who are no longer going to church can be avoided by learning or getting comfortable with having religious conversations in the home when your children are children. And, you know, I'm sorry for those where it's sort of too late, but for those who have young children, I think there's some real encouragement here to start having religious conversations in the home now. And those can be and I think this is where things like the small catechism come into play. Those can be guided by set tools. You're not alone out there to come up with the things to talk about yourself. We actually have a lot of historic resources that can be handed down that have been part of this tradition passed on to you. You know, catechesis doesn't have to be this 2-year period you do before you get communion for the first time. It should be this lifelong thing where parents and children are interacting, pastors and parishioners are interacting. It's Melanchthon puts it, your catechesis, Christian catechesis, starts at baptism and ends when you're in the grave. And so,
boy, he's a smart guy.
Yeah. And so I think we, you know, 1517 is trying to help people do that through the resources that we put out, including this podcast. But I think that's one of these things that makes some of this down the road an easier issue. Because even if people do leave the faith, there's a precedent for having these conversations with them that I know just isn't there. I have experienced so many people who, even to other Christians, are uncomfortable having conversations about spirituality, quote unquote. And I think breaking some of those barriers would go a long way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can speak from experience. Your kids are still very young and adorable. My kids are growing, and I mean, I've said it, I think at the Here We Still Stand conference, I made this comment about how my oldest was for a time a young earth atheist.
Yeah. That's the best.
You know, he had a friend whose mom was an atheist and who just basically parroted all the nonsense that Richard Dawkins says. And that was cool for a while. And it was really hard for my wife and I to not react strongly against that and just let him have his space, knowing full well that it's, you know, there's a lot of factors playing into this. And just having an open environment where those, as you said, Caleb, anything's on the table. At the dinner table, you can talk about anything, or in the car, wherever. But also for parents being, not just being relaxed in those sort of environments that you're just not accustomed to, but also having the answer, or at least the being comfortable saying, I don't know exactly right now, but hey, when we get home or after dinner, let's go on Google and start looking around. That I think goes a long way, and by extension, in our broader culture, that posture, the disposition of being. If 1 Peter 3:15, that's the classic verse for apologetics. Always be prepared to give an answer for those who ask you for a reason for the hope within you. We oftentimes, not us, of course, present company excluded, but we forget that last clause in that verse. Do this with gentleness and respect.
Yeah.
And I think, and this is kind of not my persona, but that goes a long way.
Yeah, I think, you know, part of it is we live in a culture that's used to exporting education of all types outside of the home, right? You know, kids go away for school, kids go away for Sunday school, kids go away for confirmation. Somebody else, some expert, quote unquote, handles all of this for you. And you know, I think this is one of those areas where you can import that even that relationship building it is with your kids. And, you know, there's lots of busyness in life now too, but we have to be honest with ourselves. There's lots of downtime also, in modern society. So,
I mean, Netflix binging takes some time for me.
Oh, no. You'd have to skip one episode.
You're your granddad. You're living the dream right now.
Oh, yeah. I'm living the dream, baby. Let me tell you. I made a comment the other day that I was going to add a chapter to being dad on... Well, I should probably add two. I'm not ready to add one on being a grandfather because I'm just not sure I'm that great at it. But... If you are a close family and you stay very connected to your grown children, there's a certain amount of just like parental stress that comes along with just having grown children too.
Sure.
And the one thing I made a comment to my pastor as I was seeking absolution for how I was dealing with my grown children that day, that when my kids were younger, most of the answers were pretty clear to me. Like the problems were simpler.
Mm-hmm.
And the sins were simpler too, right? And so the answers were clearer. That's not as much with grown children. I mean, it's just not. There's complications. There's people that marry into the family, and there's grandchildren. There's way. It's just,
yeah.
You know, parenting doesn't. Ron Hodel told me this not too long ago, and his kids are older than mine. It's like parenting doesn't stop when they leave the house, and I'm like, yeah, it really doesn't.
No. Yeah. He's got lots of great advice on. Kids, but one, he gave me a bit of advice years ago. He's, you know, when we had three kids, he says, oh, having four is just like having three. Not true.
I believe you. I believe you, not Ron.
If you've met Bobby.
Well, and I'm not going to bring up his name, but I don't think his youngest was the same as the other three either.
Oh, that's funny.
Kids are awesome. They're the future.
As they say it. Yeah. Well, hey, thank you for listening to this episode. I hope people out there found it interesting. I thought this was a great way to reinvestigate or relook at some of these issues with the resurrection of Christ. You know, one of the things that I'm always trying to avoid when we do episodes on topics that we've done before, which is inevitable when you've been doing a podcast for this long, is that... I don't want to feel like we're coming off stale, because I know sometimes for listeners, I get the impression that it's not, right? Like that there's a big enough gap between the episodes. But somehow when we sit down to record, it seems like we just talked about this,
yeah.
Even if it was 2 years ago, yesterday, or something like that, right? And so this was, I don't know, this was fun. This was definitely a new way to...
I'd say keep the snarky Twitter comments coming. They really seem to get Adam going.
They do, yeah. He was fired up.
You know, I was telling you how I'm on Twitter.
Adam
I don't
stalks
really do a whole lot.
Do you tweet?
But I'm a savage on Twitter. I don't do a whole lot of it.
Are you like a sniper?
Yeah.
You're a Twitter sniper? Yeah.
I would advise listeners to be very careful if you follow Adam, because he stalks my tweets, and every once in a while he'll comment. And I know he thinks it's snarky, and I know him, so I know what's going on. But sometimes they're my man.
Yeah, I called him a soy boy because I thought Twitter's like Facebook where you can have fun.
No.
No.
Facebook, you can have fun on... I don't think you can have fun on Facebook. I think you might have both of these wrong.
Okay. Let's close this up before this gets too far. And as you found out, you can follow the Thinky Fellows on Twitter. You can follow it on Facebook. You can follow us individually on there. I think Scott and Adam both have public profile pages on Facebook where you can find them. Adam and I have Twitter. You can find me. Mine's just my name, Caleb Keith. And Adam's, I think, is his name with some weird numbers behind it because he's bad at the internet. So... Hey, again, thank you for listening to this episode. We'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye.